All right. Hello, friends. Welcome to the Canadian Orange Podcast, which is an audio platform hosting conversations about creating a bright orange future for Canada, built on truth, freedom, and sound money. And this is the first episode sponsored by the Canadian Orange Party. Current block high is 922,361. Hash rate is sitting at 1,006 exahashes per second. And one Canadian peso currently buys you 681 sats. So, for context, Lucas and I met each other at the Canadian Bitcoin Conference, and we chat weekly. So we decided to record our conversations and share them in hopes that they might educate or inspire others to help build a bright orange future for Canada as well and have conversations about these things. So, yeah, I'm honored that our chat is the first episode of hopefully many by many different people. Maybe we can share what an orange future means for Canada to us. Why don't we start there? You go first.
Sure. Hey, nice to be here. An orange future. I think I see it as like a kind of gradual progression, not some like utopian endpoint, but basically just like normalizing backing our money with real things, I think, is a good start.
Agreed.
Making it kind of obvious to most of the population that it's a very strange situation that we're in right now, I think, is also good. What about you?
Yeah, I think by fixing the money, we create an opportunity to meaningfully fix all the problems we have. Because I think most people, if you go to the average Canadian today, I think most people are feeling this like uneasiness with where things are at, right? They might be feeling the squeeze of inflation, having problems, you know, making ends meet financially. They might be seeing all the various problems that Canada has. And frankly, a lot of the Western world has a lot of these problems as well. You know, it can be with the healthcare system. It can be with the economy. It can be with immigration, all these things, right? All list off the items of all the things that are really failing right now when it comes to our institutions. But I think the average person doesn't realize that all of that is built on a foundation of broken money. And I think that mismatch of most people not realizing that the money's broken and directly or indirectly, but to a significant degree affecting all the problems, is why we're not really tackling the actual problem, right? Like all these, there's a lot of politicians that are bickering over solving problems that are symptoms of the bigger problem that no one's talking about. And that's the, when you actually see it, when you go down the rabbit hole of money, you learn about money from first principles, what's good money, what's bad money, what is the, you know, what is the damage caused by currency that is fraudulent and is manipulated constantly by a select group of people? What are the trickle-down effects of that for everyone that lives under that monetary regime? And when you see that for what it is, you realize how nasty it is, how big of a problem it is. And I guess for me, initially, it was kind of a relief where it's like, oh, all these messed up things actually have a clear source. So understanding that was nice. Right? It gives you like a sense of ease of just being able to make sense of it all. But then as time goes on and you see nothing being done to actually solve that problem, it creates frustration where it's like, hey, why aren't we talking about the elephant in the room, which is the fact that our money's broken down and causing gradual degradation of all of our institutions and degradation of the quality of life for the average people. So I think to me, you know, the orange movement transcends politics. Transcends economics. It's really just a social movement to adopt a sound money standard, which can act as a foundation to sort of effectively rebuild a lot of the institutions in Canada on a foundation of truth and freedom instead of lies and control, which is kind of where it's at right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the, like you say, realizing and naming the problem in this way, it depersonalizes, it takes away your any reason you had to hate a particular person or politician or institution or like wing of the government, it kind of removes that, which is very freeing. And then in its place is this massive system with no one really at the center, but just a system of incentives that will just continue to erode the quality of life of everyone under that system. So every Canadian is just going to gradually have their purchasing power eroded from them. Everything's going to get harder unless it changes, unless the system changes. And that's, yeah, where the kind of hatred and the frustration at individuals and political decisions and everything leaves. It's filled with this very frustrating, difficult to handle problem. That's, yeah.
Yeah, and I agree. I think it starts with being pissed off at your local politician, right? It's like, why aren't you doing what you're supposed to do? Why isn't my life getting better? You're representing me. You're supposed to make my life better. It's not getting better. It's getting worse. Something's wrong with this person. Then it's sort of people who go a layer deeper realize, well, actually the whole mechanism of politics is flawed in the way that we do it. And that's where they create, you know, goes from the boogeyman of a specific person. You know, and even before that, before people even looked at their own politicians, it might be listening to mainstream propaganda and saying, oh, it's Trump's fault, or it's X person's fault, or this industry's fault, or the billionaire's fault, or all these things, all these people that are kind of scapegoated as a source of problems, but aren't actually the source of problems. Then it goes to the politician, and then it goes to, okay, well, the system's broken, right? And the people that get to there realize that actually the flaw in the way we're doing things transcends individuals and single entities. It's like the whole machine is flawed. But I think a lot of people get stuck there and yell at the system and vote because it makes them feel like they have some sense of agency or control or choice in the matter. But I don't think there's a lot of people that get the next layer deeper, which is the money is the found, everything is downstream of money. So the quote unquote system that includes like the political system, the health system, the education system, all of these things are essentially downstream of money. And if the money is flawed, if the money's fraudulent and built on lies, everything downstream that's built on that money is going to have a set of incentives that are fraudulent and based on manipulation and lies. And so it's helping people. I think the Orange Party and the Orange Movement is about reclaiming freedom by restoring a sound money standard. But I think what it's really about is trying to bring people's attention away from all the superficial symptomatic problems to the actual core problem that we can all agree on needs to be solved, right? Like you and I might differ radically in our opinions to the point where we're, you know, if we still believe voting in the traditional political system works, maybe you're voting red, I'm voting blue team. Because we disagree on either the person's talking points or the platform of these political parties. But at the end of the day, we can still disagree on all those things, but find agreement and unity on the fact that, well, if the money's broken, all these problems are not going to go away permanently. And we can both agree that our lives will be better if our purchasing power is not constantly debased, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the reality is people just don't understand they're being stolen from. They don't understand how money works. That Henry Ford quote is just a really powerful one. It says, it's probably good that people don't understand how banking and money system works, because if they did, we'd have a revolution in the morning. And I think what he's saying there is people don't actually diagnose the problem correctly, which is why there's no coordinated action to solve it. And I think the Orange Movement, yes, orange is the color of Bitcoin. Yes, orange is a third option instead of red and blue. But I think orange fundamentally is just a way to be able to unite people together to actually look at, talk about, and solve the core problem, which is so long as we have currency that can be manipulated by a select few people to maintain their power and control, whether that's their intention or not, right? This is just where the incentives lead to. We need to address that. And there is actually a way to address it. And there are strategies that we can discuss to fix that that aren't like super abstract out there imagination things. They're actually concrete things that can be done. And if we bring the conversation there, I think we can achieve way more progress by just unifying on the big thing that's causing a lot of these trickle-down problems. So I think that's the value of that. To me, the Orange Movement is a social movement to reclaim honest money in a society, which I think fixes many. I think it improves every other problem, probably fixes a lot of them, and gives us at least a true opportunity to meaningfully solve all the problems that aren't immediately solved by solving the problem of money.
Yeah, and I feel like people intuitively have this sense of things degrading gradually in the world around them. There's this kind of like, whether it's from just horrible things happening in the media or, you know, your paycheck to paycheck lifestyle is getting more challenging or that. I think that having an option, like you say, for both kind of political wings or all for everyone, regardless of their political leanings is great. And I think that heading it off early is important because things can get bad if, you know, like
really bad.
Yeah. Like this doesn't, this gets worse and worse until the solution that we're talking about is implemented. I think I am not a macroeconomist and I don't know how, you know, hyperinflating currencies or, you know, governments, like major governments defaulting works, but it does not get better when you have less and less collateral backing your debt. You know, it's like we have a collateral problem right now where we just have nothing backing this paper that we're just pumping into existence. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's, I mean, that part of the challenge of talking about this on this first episode is it's such a big, giant topic. You can go in a million directions.
Yep.
But I think at the essence of it, I mean, one thing I had texted you to kind of think about and bring here was if you think of the Orange Movement as a social movement to fix the money, right? The whole moniker of the Canadian Orange Party is, you know, there's this mantra in Bitcoin, fix the money, fix the world. Well, if we bring that into Canada, fix the money, fix Canada. Does fixing the money immediately fix Canada overnight? No. Can we actually fix anything meaningfully without fixing the money? I also think no. So why don't we just start there? Because that it's clearly the biggest problem and it's not being addressed, which in and of itself is a giant problem. But this orange movement that transcends politics, that transcends this political game that constantly is being played to really create divisiveness and play people off each other. And, you know, if you make someone the enemy, you can come in as the savior. And I think that is literally the crux of politics, right? Is always finding the boogeyman, blaming the mess on them, claiming to have the solution, even though that solution always involves printing more money and making things incredibly worse in the long run. The idea that a politician really just has a short shelf life is like they don't really have to care beyond their period of tenure about the consequences of this, right? So I think even just politics in and of itself within a regime of money that can be created that's not tethered to anything is going to cause major problems. And I think if, you know, if anyone out there wants to get an understanding of what happens in these scenarios, just look at history. Look, as a case study, research Weimar Germany, hyperinflation. See how that ended up. It didn't end up well for anyone involved. And so, yeah, I think we can stave off a huge amount of suffering by acknowledging this problem early and actually solving it before the rest of the world. Right? Because every nation has their own problem, which is they all have broken money. They all have these manipulated fiat currencies that have gotten out of control since we left a gold standard. And I also think most people don't realize the Canadian dollar used to be backed by gold. Before we tethered to the US dollar, we were backed by gold. We left a gold standard. We pegged ourselves to the US dollar. The US dollar left a gold standard. And all of a sudden, we're all floating in no man's land in this fake reality. Under the illusion that we're all getting wealthier because the number that's attached to the value of our home, the number that's attached to the value of our stocks are all going up. But no one's factoring in the fact that the purchasing power of those numbers is taking a free fall, unless you're looking at the world through a Bitcoin lens, in which case it's not Bitcoin that's going up exponentially. It's everything else is collapsing in value relative to Bitcoin. Bitcoin is just Bitcoin. One Bitcoin is one Bitcoin. It's 100 million Satoshis. That's what it's going to be. When you compare Bitcoin to the Canadian dollar, it looks like it's going parabolically upward. Same thing with the US dollar. Same thing with the Venezuelan Bolivar. Same thing with the Turkish lira. All these currencies look like, you know, it looks like Bitcoin's going up in this crazy vertical arc against all these currencies, but it's not Bitcoin that's doing that. It's all those currencies becoming exponentially less valuable because they're creating more units of them. So this whole idea of, everyone's heard of inflation. Everyone probably feels some semblance of how inflation is affecting them in their lives. But I think the sad reality is most people are propagandized into believing inflation is 2-3% increase in prices every year, which is good and normal, and there's nothing wrong there. When the reality is, the past 5 years, Canadian dollars inflated at an average of 8.5% per year. And so the only reason that that might not show up in people's lives is because technology is actually making everything less expensive every year, right? If we weren't inflating the currency, everything would be getting cheaper. Houses would be getting cheaper, cars, insurance, everything we need would be getting cheaper because technology is making it easier and easier to make things for less.
And in the current system that we have, that changing, that those products becoming cheaper, would be catastrophic for everyone. And so basically having to turning around this ship so that people are not being stolen from, I think is like priority one for civilization right now. It's not just Canadian. It's every country needs to be having this in their, on their list of priorities. But I guess that's what we're doing here, is just trying to find a way to make it so that we stop inflation and we make a system that allows for the deflation that is natural and good in the free market to occur, and enrich everyone in the process and not allow people to be completely leveled due to their leverage and due to a deflating currency. And no one wants like everyone's houses to deteriorate in the value of their paper money, and have a bunch of people unable to pay for them. But we need to find a way of, like I say, turning this giant ship around.
And it's not, I mean, there's no pain-free path. That's the other thing to say. It's like, it's not like we fix the money, no pain, hurrah, it's great. All we're doing is looking at multiple paths of varying degrees of pain and suffering and crappiness, frankly. And oftentimes what is least painful in the short term ends up being most painful in the long term. So the least painful thing, the least stressful thing is don't do anything, print a bunch more money, give a Band-Aid solution, give everyone $1,000 check. So everyone gets through this month and next month feels a bit better. Tax people a little bit less. That's like the instant gratification that doesn't solve anything meaningful, but gives people a little sense that things have gotten a tiny bit better for this month. The harder thing to do is to acknowledge the fact that our money's broken, have the hard discussions of, okay, the money's broken. It's a big problem to have a currency that's not connected to any value, which means the government can print as much as it wants, whenever it wants, without restriction, run deficits, put future generations of Canadians into debt with no limit on how much debt they can create. Right? I think the Liberals just came out with their budget. It's like $70 billion in the negative. Someone has to pay that.
Yeah.
Someone who works and spends their time and energy to earn money has to pay that in future in taxes or in gains or whatever it might be. So it's like the dude that's making decisions right now just chose to put our children $70 billion into debt. That's the most unfair thing I've ever heard of. And the only reason it's accepted is because it's normalized that these giant billion trillion numbers are literally just these meaningless abstract figures that the overlords in parliament have decided to do. And people are so disconnected from what that even means and the implications of that downstream that they're basically numb to even acknowledging the reality of what that means. And I think fixing the money means tethering the amount of money units that can be created to something real in the real world. Historically, it was gold. I think if we look forward, maybe it's a basket of hard assets that you can't print out of nowhere, right? That are grounded in some level, that are grounded in physics. Like gold, you cannot just create gold out of nowhere. You have to put a lot of time, energy, and money, and fuel, and labor into mining gold out of the ground. It's actually a really messy, nasty process. But there's no, you know, if you want to create an ounce of gold, which is $4,000 right now, you're going to have to put, if you're really good at it, you might spend $3,700 to get that $4,000 ounce out of the ground. There's no circumventing that.
Yeah, I was thinking about it in terms of, let's say you own a house. The bank is giving you a massive loan collateralized by that house. So if you owing $300,000 or $500,000 without anything collateralizing it is bad for most people. Like that is a dangerous situation to be in. And, but when it's secured with something, say like in the government example, gold, Bitcoin, that's another conversation, but, for the individual collateralized by your mortgage, collateralized by your home, it's healthy and safe in the current system. But right now my understanding of it is we're basically printing out billions of dollars collateralized by absolutely nothing.
Correct.
So it's just, yeah. I mean, it's an unconscionable devaluing of our children's time and their children's time and energy. 'Cause that's what money is. And when you can print something that you have to work for into existence, that's terrible. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, just the idea that you and I have to work, spend our time and energy to earn a certain amount of money, but there's a certain group of people who can press a button on a computer and print millions and potentially even billions of hours worth of human time out of nowhere with nothing backing it, with nothing restraining how much they can print. That's insane.
That's a debt for your society.
Yeah.
A debt that is paid by your children. It is unconscionable.
Yeah, it's immoral, it's unfair, and it's extremely harmful. So just the idea, the basic premise that currency inflation is immoral, unethical, unfair, and extremely harmful and should be stopped, shouldn't be a controversial thing.
Yeah.
That's all we're trying to get at with the orange movement, is to say, most people don't know this is going on. It is going on. It's really heinous. And the only reason we accept it is because we're all born into a system that has normalized it and propagandized us into thinking it's okay. And we all need to wake up and take a bit more agency in our lives if we actually want to change this. Because the system is not going to change itself, right? The state and the government that controls the money, along with bankers, is not incentivized to stop the gravy train of being able to create as much money as they want. Right? What they are incentivized to do is to take away more of our freedoms so that we can't push back on this crazy thing they're doing that no one really has woken up to yet. And the only way to solve this, the path to solving this begins with a very simple premise, which is financial literacy must improve in Canada so people can see what's actually happening, to be motivated enough and frankly angry enough to actually go out of their way to participate in the process of change. And I think it's so easy to be super nihilistic that this quote unquote system is this big headless machine that can never be stopped and can't be changed. But the reality is it can be changed and must be changed, or else we're all going like.
It will change. It's just a matter of how much, how awful it will be when it does.
Correct.
I think.
And the earlier, it's like a sickness, right?
Yeah.
Okay, you have a sickness. If you don't change your behaviors, the sickness will get worse, and the end result is death if nothing changes. You're on a trajectory to death if you're sick and you're not changing your behaviors. So the sooner you change your behaviors, the less likely we are to die, and the less pain you will experience with the passage of time. So we are on a path to death as a country. So we are on a path to socioeconomic death as a country. Bankrupt. We're already bankrupt. Like, this is, the ship has sailed. We're already bankrupt. We already have way less money. You know, it's like simple math that you have to do as a head of household. We should earn more money than we spend and save the difference so that in future, if unexpected things happen, we have reserves. If you run a family or if you run a business, for example, and you are earning far less than you're spending every single year, you are already bankrupt. You already have you have a net balance below zero. So you owe more than you have, and you're owing exponentially more. And the amount that you owe also has interest charges on it. So it accelerates the pace of growth of the amount that you owe, assuming that what you're generating isn't changing. So we're already bankrupt. We are on a trajectory to create exponentially more debt, to enslave and burden future generations of Canadians with exponentially more debt, and to create grounds where people are suffering so much that they will listen to some crazy plan that someone proposes because they're so desperate. That sounds very similar to Nazi Germany.
It sounds similar to countries right now around the world. This is the path. This is a predictable cyclical path that countries on bad money follow. And it's
every time. It's never ended differently. Like, it's,
yeah.
And maybe it's that people don't actually have a grasp of history that creates the grounds for people not knowing where this is heading. And frankly, I think most people don't know history, and potentially history is trying to be modified and deleted so that people can't find out the truth. And I think also in a world of degrading money, of broken money that is degrading the fabric of society and worsening quality of life, it immediately thrusts people into survival mode where actually they don't have spare bandwidth to be creative, pursue interests, hobbies, or even just learn about the world. Why? Because they're concerned about putting food on the table and paying their mortgage next month for their family. So everyone's stuck in this loop of survival mode. They don't have the ability to actually step away and think, okay, why is this happening? What does history tell us about the circumstances we're in and how those end? How can we fix this problem? And the irony is, I think Bitcoiners, people who have saved their time in Bitcoin and protected that time from being stolen, are the only ones with spare time and bandwidth to actually think about these problems from a broader sense and how we solve them. And the unfortunate thing is I think a lot of Bitcoiners actually just look at the system of politics as just a fundamentally disconnected system from reality that is almost a farce and theater at this point. And the problem that I'm seeing is becoming more obvious now is that because of that, they opt out of even participating at all. So the people who have the best understanding of how things work and the best ability to build and solve problems are opting out of the pool of people that actually play an active role in governance. And that's a big problem. And so I think this all just starts by building awareness around money. And I think that's fundamentally the mission that we're trying to do with the Orange Movement through the Canadian Orange Party, Canadian Orange Podcast, eventually a financial literacy nonprofit, is just, let's have some sort of countermeasure to the propaganda telling people money's not a problem. It's normal for inflation of 2-3% to happen. We need a countermeasure to actually introduce truth to counteract the lies. Because if we don't change that, nothing is going to change and things will continue degrading worse and worse and worse. The faces of the quote unquote leaders will change. The color of their teams might change, but nothing fundamental will change enough to avoid the catastrophe. And if you have kids, like you have kids, I have kids, it creates a deeper meaning to look forward in the future beyond just your life.
Yeah, it's something that I'm still kind of adjusting to, this idea that it's even possible for there to be a better future.
Yeah.
It's a wild idea to even not even have considered it a possibility, because we're so cynical, you know, it's like, it's so easy to just think that everything is going to hell, but yeah, it's,
But when you can, when you, I think by understanding it, you actually see something tangible that could potentially change, even if it seems far-fetched or a heavy lift initially, right? It's like, okay, in theory, overnight, we could pass a bill in the government to say, we are no longer able to print money out of nowhere. We have to back the Canadian dollar with a basket of hard assets held in military secured vaults. And the amount of assets we have is a governor on how much currency we can create. So if we want to print $1 billion worth of currency into circulation, we have to have accumulated $1 billion worth of hard assets, Bitcoin, gold, precious metals, perhaps. And so we limit ourselves, we put guardrails on how much money we can create. And because there's something backing it, we no longer have this exorbitant privilege of creating as much money as we want without any constraint. So surely that will slow the rate of currency. Currency will still inflate, but it will be governed by some real tangible thing instead of by nothing. That's a way better, that's a good start. And in theory, that could happen tomorrow if we want. If literally everyone tomorrow got zapped by an insight and saw the light, and all the politicians and all the Canadians all agreed that, okay, it's not good to be able to inflate currency without anything governing how much we inflate it, why don't we stop doing that? And instantly, you have to actually, the government has to look at themselves and say, well, we can't spend $70 billion more than we received. So where do we have to cut that? Well, trim away all the things that are creating waste, right? All the government jobs where people aren't really delivering value to Canadians, aren't actually doing anything productive for the economy, those have to get trimmed. And there's a period of time where those people don't have jobs, but there's also an opening, an unlocking of human talent, creativity, and motivation to do something that people love that gets opened up. And so it literally just forces us to sharpen the pencil to say, well, okay, if we were considering giving $20 million to Guatemalan farmers for diversity, maybe we shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. We can't just print billions of dollars, so we can't give money away to these silly things that don't benefit Canadians at all and frankly are usually just money laundering schemes disguised as some good cause. All of that gets a light gets shown on all that, and a lot of it gets pruned away, which is good for Canadians because every dollar they print makes the dollar that you hold and I hold worth less. This is the thing people miss. It's like they're taking half of it in taxes. What are we getting in return for that? That's a conversation of its own. You know, the whole idea of the libertarian philosophy where, you know, the nonviolence principle, the non-aggression principle, and the idea that we should not be coerced and threatened with violence if we don't give the government money. Like, that's its own conversation. But even aside from that, even aside from all the various different taxes and whether or not they are moral, ethical, or even deserved, printing money and debasing everyone's time, stealing from everyone, is this invisible tax that is largely unacknowledged and is the source of so much waste and fraud. And if we just fix the money, we immediately trim so much waste and fraud and make life better for everyone. And I can't imagine anyone opposing that actually understands what's going on unless they have some perverse incentive to continue the current system because they're benefiting disproportionately.
Yeah, I think that there's a mixture of incentives and motivations. There are some people cynically drawing this energy from the system that's obviously awful, but I think that there's people that just genuinely believe, like, okay, yeah, 2%, you know, maybe we're at 3% inflation, but we'll get it down to 2 and everything's going to be good. And they kind of, I don't know if they're overeducated or maybe undereducated about economics and to the point where they think that this Keynesian model is benefiting us in some way. I think that we have no choice but to just disagree staunchly against that or disagree with that.
I think they genuinely believe it's not a bad thing.
Yeah, like, no, I think that their motives, generally speaking, they come from not understanding what they're doing. I don't think that's why, like, I think as a sort of attitude, I'm trying to take into this, like, normally I'm pretty ornery, kind of type A, like I get grumpy about what's happening and everything. I am trying to kind of sublimate that and be optimistic about it, something that's kind of against my character, but I think that there is cause to be optimistic. It's like, hey, we know the problem and we have somewhat of a solution, and we're just going to keep iterating this process until we see improvement, I think. And I'm not blaming anyone. I don't hate anyone. I don't hate Mark Carney. I don't hate Polyev. I don't hate Trump. I don't hate, like, these people are product of their incentives. And I think that just changing the incentives, that's what fix the money, fix the world, fix the money, fix Canada is. It's changing the incentives surrounding money. It's changing everything. And this is when I think the attitude of win-win is, so many of these economic systems are I win, you lose.
Yep.
And that's why we fight each other. And it's pretty wild to actually have a solution that is win-win, I would say, at least for 99% of us. And I do think that the 1%, I haven't fully played it out in my head, but I think the 1% and the 0.01%, I think they all can benefit from this. They are just plugged into this disgusting slop machine. Sludge factory that is the fiat system. And they would, I think, I don't know, maybe I'm just being generous, but I think they would love to be unplugged from it and be given a life of purpose and wealth and beauty and all that stuff that comes from sound money.
Yeah, that was really well said. And I agree. If we took 10%, if you just as a thought experiment, you have a way to quantify energy expended by a human, emotional energy, physical energy, thought energy, mental energy. If you took 10% of all the energy that all Canadians are spending being angry at individuals, being angry at the system, yelling at policies, going to protests, being angry about their taxes, being angry about their expenses going up, fighting symptomatic issues in the fiat system. If you took 10% of that energy and you funneled and channeled all of that towards solving the core problem of broken, dishonest money, you would change it in a second. And so it's like the Orange Movement is a quest to focus everyone's energy on the root cause problem that must be solved in order for any other problems to have an opportunity to be solved. And I think sometimes Bitcoiners get a little bit simplistic saying, even the mantra, fix the money, fix the world. It's like,
it's pretty quixotic.
I agree with it.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of nuance to actually go into, okay, well, how do the mechanics of that shake out in reality, pragmatically? Mm-hmm. Right. And we were chatting one day and you kind of said, there's this notion that fixing the money fixes Canada or fixes the world. But then there's this leap through this layer of unknown of, like, how does it actually do that? What actually changes? The money gets fixed tomorrow. What actually changes? Can we imagine those changes? Can we actually tangibly believe that those changes will actually happen? What are the probabilities of those changes happening? Yeah. And so I think diving into that gray zone where people aren't really going there and maybe not being able to imagine that might be the main obstacle to them actually pursuing that reality, because they don't even know that that reality is possible or aren't even aware of, like, how does this actually shake out? And yeah, I think there's a lot of, I mean, Jeff Booth is a super strong, super smart human. And one thing I've heard him say is, if you have abundant money, you have scarcity everywhere. Mm-hmm. If you have scarce money, you have abundance everywhere. And I think that holds true. And so I think the reason we have mass scarcity is because we have abundant money. So there's all these pieces of paper floating around fighting for a select few things that you can't just increase overnight, right? Canada can't increase its lumber production by 100% overnight. It can't increase its gold production by 100% overnight. Canada can create $1 trillion in a second. And by flooding the Canadian economy with all these dollars, it makes everything that can't be increased in production in a short period of time more scarce. And by having scarce money, we allow everything to be more accessible because every dollar you hold goes further in buying things that you want, right? Those things can't be increased in supply overnight, but and it's almost hard to put words to this because it's such a big idea, right? But I think when I bring it down to simple terms, it's like money is the foundation for civilization. Everything is downstream of money. Corrupted money means all the institutions are de facto corrupted. Justice is corrupted. Economics is corrupted. Everything that's built on money becomes tainted by the foundation if the foundation is flawed or fraudulent. And so if we take this foundation that's built on a lie and corrupting everything else downstream and we switch it out with a foundation that's built on truth, everything that's built on top of it embodies that value of truth as it's built. And so you have this, you know, you have dishonest money will attract dishonest politicians. If you have honest money, you will attract honest people, right? Because the people who resonate with the incentives built into the game gravitate towards playing that game. And it's almost like on a foundation of dishonest money, all the honest people have moved away from politics. Because they're like, it's dishonest, the system is flawed, it's corrupted. But no one's gone the layer deeper to say, well, it's the money. It's not the system. The system is a derivative of the foundation, which is money. And fixing the system without fixing the money does nothing. Which is why I think so many people are frustrated. It's like, I'm voting for this person who's saying great things to that they're going to make my life better, but nothing actually ends up materializing and being true. So I just discount the whole institutional politics as flawed and unfixable because they haven't gone the layer deeper to say, well, it's actually the money that's the problem. And if we haven't fixed the money, there's no reason to think politics would ever change because it's just a derivative of the money. And if the environment, if the base incentives don't change, the outcomes will never change meaningfully. They might change slightly, but they won't change meaningfully enough to actually move the needle or change the trajectory we're on.
Yeah, and I think realistically, you touched briefly on the nuts and bolts, the details of how this, for some reason, this metaphor of a ship turning around comes to mind. I'm sure there's better analogies. I think it's a good metaphor. Make, but like, as far as that metaphor goes, you turn the ship too quick, or let's say you turn the boat too quickly, you're going to capsize. And like, I think that we should be sensitive to this idea of like, I don't want a family of five who just bought a house to have their house devalued due to some epic deflationary event where, you know, everything, all of our, you know, our eggs are cheaper and our houses are cheaper. And we just have, sure, that's a lot of abundance for in this narrow view, but all of a sudden you have this poor family kind of defaulting on their mortgage as their house is now, they're basically unable to pay down the principal on this huge loan they took out because that's what, you know, let's say you took out there's kind of a common meme in Bitcoin where you have the house price of, there's one house, it's $230,000 and it's X number of Bitcoin 5 years ago, 10 years ago. That number in 10 years later in Bitcoin terms is much lower. The original value, if you took out a mortgage, let's imagine you took out a mortgage for 200 Bitcoin 5 years ago. I don't know if those numbers track, but I'm not doing math publicly right now.
Sorry, but I'm following you.
And that becomes your mortgage. You pay down, you're gradually paying down the principal. At the time, it would take you 3 to 5 years to pay down your principal based on your earnings, you know, 25-year mortgage, whatever. 25 years from now, your house is going to be worth, you know, at 0.00, you know, who knows, Bitcoin, and you're still paying down 200 Bitcoin worth of house over that time. That's like, this is a danger of deflation. So this, maybe I'm giving kind of a steel man argument, anticipating some sort of argument there, but.
Well, even put it in fiat, it might be easier to understand.
Yeah.
Someone buys a home that's $500,000. So at the time they buy it, it's $500,000. They put $100,000 down. They have a $400,000 mortgage. Mm-hmm. If that house gets cut in value by two, because we have a big deflationary event, that house is worth $250,000. That family now owes $400,000 on a $250,000 house. That's bad.
Yeah. If you're trying to buy a house in that environment, that's great. However, it's complicated. And I think like my whole point in this is that whatever approach we take, I think should take into account all of these, like not making the perfect the enemy of the good, trying to come up with equitable solutions for everyone. I'm not trying to it's obviously not trying to immiserate anyone, but I think that there are no solutions. There are only trade-offs. Thomas Sowell, it's like the people bringing up these solutions will always seem like the bad guy, given the incentives. The people printing money and giving you a paycheck for doing absolutely nothing will seem like the good guy. And your children and your children's children will thank you for trying to steer the ship even slightly off course, or I suppose on course for this confusing analogy. But I think...
Well, the ship metaphor is good because it's like we're on a ship. There's a lot of momentum and inertia. It's a big ship with a lot of people. Doesn't turn on a dime. It's like a freight train. Maybe a freight train is a better one. The freight train is on a set of tracks that are literally pointing towards a giant boulder with a bomb on it. So we know it's coming. We can see it. We know historically every train that has been on a set of tracks heading for a boulder with a bomb on it is going to blow up and everyone's gonna die. And that is essentially the metaphor for every society that has ever operated on a fiat standard where money can be created, not tethered to anything of real value, ends up getting obliterated and a huge amount of suffering gets created. Yes, there is work that goes into rebuilding the tracks. Take like literally building a new set of tracks that move away from the boulder, putting the time and energy into deciding where should we even point the tracks, calculating, okay, based on the trajectory of how fast we're going, where should we actually split the track to go in a different direction? Because if we do it too soon and we can't slow the train down in time, the train flips over, derails, and everything blows up early. So there's like a lot of sensitivity required to actually decide, okay, like switching, building new tracks it's like, I think everyone can agree, let's not run into the rock with a bomb on it. Like most people will be like, yeah, I agree. I'm not suicidal. I don't want that. Great. That's the equivalent of we should fix the money. Then there's, well, once we can get on board with that and decide that that's the path to go down, it's like, okay, how do we roll this out based on the economic environment we're in right now, based on where the world is at, what all the other countries are doing, and the people in Canada and the situations they find themselves in? That's a really big conversation to have. A lot of smart people have to come to the table, acknowledge all the trade-offs, propose different ideas, think them through, map out, model out how that shakes out. Like there's a lot of work to do there. But if we're not even acknowledging, here's where we are right now. We're not even acknowledging that we're on tracks headed towards a boulder with a bomb on it. The first step, and what I think is like the mission of the Orange Movement, is help people understand we are on a really bad trajectory. Yes, you have problems in your day-to-day life and you have struggles that maybe prevent you from even thinking a month ahead of time. But it's for the sake of your kids and for the sake of everyone else in Canada, I think we should all take a bit of responsibility to participate in that discussion, because when we trust a small group of people to represent us and make good choices that are within this broken system where they don't even acknowledge, like the politicians aren't even acknowledging that the boulder and the bomb is there. And we're trusting them to make choices of what direction we're going, how fast the train is going, and like, you know, what kind of covers we put on the seats. And they're bickering over all these little details and they're not acknowledging the rock, the boulder with the bomb. So I think it's really just a grassroots social movement to start the conversation about building awareness that corrupted money inevitably leads to a very bad outcome. We need to do something differently. We need to solve that problem. We need to fix the money, tether it to something that's real, like gold or Bitcoin or a basket of assets that can't be created out of nowhere. And then it's, okay, how do we actually implement and execute that over a specific time frame to mitigate, to achieve the best potential outcome, to not avoid all damage, because it's not possible at this point. Like, we're left with a pretty big problem that wasn't, you and I didn't create this problem. You know, it's pretty easy to get angry at boomers to say, you got us here and you created this problem. At the end of the day, they were just a product of the environment that birthed them too, right? Like, it's no pointing fingers to say who put the problem here, who put the boulder there with the bomb on it. You spend all day doing that, you actually don't have any energy to actually avoid it.
I mean, I own a house. I am actively contributing to this problem right now, in my view, in my kind of, I don't know if it's a, not, I'm not trying to like self-flagellate or anything. Just, I think that given my ability to save a certain amount of money that most people, like I think a lot of people in Canada would have a hard time saving, just because I was able to do that. I was able to get a huge loan for a very long duration, very cheap, and buy a house. I think that qualifies for being a part of the problem in a certain view. I don't judge other people for having it. Again, this is not, I'm not trying to tell people that they're doing anything wrong or saying that I hate anyone, but I think, all that to say, I certainly don't point fingers at a certain generation. This is an incentives problem.
Yep.
It does not matter who was there at the time. There, but for the grace of God, go you, I think is, like you would have done the same, I think.
I agree.
Yeah. And,
but it doesn't change the fact that we have to acknowledge it and fix it.
Well, yeah, 100%. I'm not, this isn't like some sort of moral relativism. Like, I think that like being accountable for your actions is important. I think that, but I think that, practically, which I think that being practical in this case, like being angry at a given politician or a certain generation of people is not helpful. It is counterproductive to actually getting something done, in my opinion. I think maybe there's a place for it. Maybe certain personalities are maybe that conversation has to start getting people angry, getting people incensed. I'm kind of agnostic as to that. But I know in my life, I am far more motivated by like positive outcomes and optimism. And all the negative, like all the like fear and anger porn out there is just
distracting.
It's just distracting. It sucks your energy. And I think that just moving on and being kind of, I don't know if more stoic or more pragmatic is the word for that. But yeah, I think it's important. For me personally, I don't know, people can obviously take whatever attitude they like and that they feel is productive, but I think that generally it's more productive to make friends than enemies. Because ultimately it is for everyone. It is for, like, I don't know. It's for communists. It's for libertarians, I think. I think a communist government or a libertarian government or just a, you know, I think they'll all do better on a sound money standard, but I don't know.
I agree. I think life is better for everyone when civilization is built on truth and freedom. That's it. I think that's really what we're trying to have conversations about, trying to focus our energy on. I think if everyone was more careful with their energy and more mindful to avoid wasting energy, yelling at boogeymen, getting angry at things that they're not doing anything to take action to change, and they focus that energy on some sort of solution, and that solution might mean expanding their understanding of how money works. That solution might mean sharing that message with other people, friends, families, coworkers. That solution might mean reaching out to a local politician and saying, hey, I just learned about broken money. It's pretty disturbing. We need to solve this problem. What are you doing to vocalize solutions within the political theater? And if they're not doing anything, maybe it's an invitation to educate them and point them to a resource that shows that the money is broken, how it's broken, what the outcome is with broken money over a long enough time horizon, and potential solutions on the horizon that we can focus our energy with talking about. So we all, it's going to take all of us to change this. And I think it begins individually with being more careful with how we spend our energy, not getting distracted, and having something that gives us hope to look forward to, right? Like, even if you're struggling super hard right now, the fact that you can buy $10 worth of Bitcoin and save in a form of money that doesn't steal your time, that will be worth more in future than it is now, is a pretty hopeful thing. Sadly, most people don't know that exists or that it's within reach. Many get distracted with crypto or get kind of nihilistic with how hopeless life can seem at times. But I think we all need a source of hope. And I think the emblem of the orange movement is the bright orange maple leaf, because in a dark world, you know, the bright orange maple leaf stands out as a beacon of hope in a dark black background. And I think anytime you see the bright orange maple leaf, you can think of a bright orange future for Canada that's within reach and within grasp, but is going to require everyone to take a bit more responsibility and agency to actually make that a reality. And it starts by you making it a reality in your personal life, then you making it a reality for your family, your community, your church, your company, your local area, your city, your province, and eventually your country. But it begins with individuals. And so if you're listening to this and this resonated, then join the orange movement.
And if you think we're wrong about anything, just find a way to get a hold of us and let us know, because we're both learning in this. I think we're all learning in this field. And yeah, I just think that the more people that disagree, like, just send it all our way and we'll try and learn from it and make it a better solution. Because yeah,
agreed. I think that's a good place to wrap. That's an hour.
Cool.
These conversations will vary in length, and frankly, they might vary widely in topics. We might talk about health,
yeah,
parenting, money, solutions to the big problems. I mean, everything will be tethered in and kind of grounded in this idea of fixing the money to fix Canada and returning to a sound money standard, what that means and what we imagine that could change. There's also going to be a lot of different voices on this platform. The goal isn't for it to just be Lucas and I. We'll have conversations probably once a week. But if you are having great conversations around any topics related to freedom, sound money, or truth as it relates to Canada, and you're a Canadian with a perspective to share, have a conversation with someone, record it, send it to us. You can email CanadianOrangeParty@protonmail.com. Send us the conversation. We'll put it on the platform. The more voices we can have and be put out there, the better.
Is it .com or is it .me?
.com.
.com. Okay.
Yep.
Cool.
Anything else to say?
No.
We'll talk
to you. I mean, yes, but
yes, but we'll save it. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week. Ciao.